Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
So we get caught up in fighting the lie. Right. Oh, my God, look at Trump. He's such a liar. No, no. Look around the lie.
So it's also partly lazy journalism where we're focused on the immediate lie and not on the actual bigger
because vision. The lie pisses you off.
Right.
The lie's like, you piece of shit. How did you say that Obama? You know Obama didn't do that.
From Topic and Earwolf, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm Hari Kondabolu. The answer to the question, what does the H in Jesus H. Christ stand for?
The show where two comedians try to make sense of politics in America.
Except when it's baseball season. Then I'm all baseball all the time. Most people don't know this, but I'm a conservative when it comes to baseball. No more designated hitter. End interleague play.
Bring back the dead ball. Dead ball. Dead ball.
And with that, we lost 70% of our listeners. Now, in America, we often focus on the face of social movements. But what we don't talk about enough is the many, many important people working behind the scenes.
Our guest today is one of those people, Michael Skolnick.
Here he is in 2014 speaking at the Generation Progress Fight for a Future National Summit.
When you go back to your communities, let us not just fight for the dignity and humanity of our young people and our friends in their death. Let us fight for the dignity and humanity of our friends in their life.
Hey, Hari, why don't we just skip recording the podcast and just play the rest of that speech?
Because then people will know that you and I are relevant and they can just look up stuff on the internet and have a much more fulfilling experience.
From 2009 to 2015, Michael actually worked as the political director for hip-hop pioneer himself, Russell Simmons. He went on to found Soze, a social impact campaign agency. And before all this, he spent years as a film producer and director.
Michael is the kind of person who has his hand in just about everything.
In 2012, Michael wrote an op-ed for Global Grind that went viral. It was called White People, You Will Never Look Suspicious Like Trayvon Martin.
He also worked with Jay-Z and Gathering for Justice to get I Can't Breathe t-shirts to LeBron James after Eric Garner's death. LeBron James wore one of those shirts before an NBA game.
And if you're not familiar with Michael or his work, you may think from what we just said or all of his accomplishments that he's black. But he's not. He's just a regular old white guy. But he's so good at racial justice, people want to make him black. Kind of like that white basketball player on the N1 tour, The Professor.
The Professor!
Because as a white person, we have to begin to understand, I don't feel guilty for being white. I'm not ashamed of being white. It was the hand that I was dealt. It was the card that came out of the deck. It's what I got. But when I got that, when I was lucky enough to be a man, to be white, to be an American, I got choices to make. The choices that I'm going to make is I'm not going to be quiet. I'm not going to watch a kid get shot in the chest and just be quiet.
Dear white listeners, take a tip from Michael.
Yeah, rewind that part and listen again.
I'm not going to watch a kid get shot in the chest and just be quiet.
We'll talk to Michael about what he's learned from working behind the scenes in the movement, who inspires him, who challenges him.
And what strengths do we have when facing 45? And we may even talk a little New York Knicks basketball, or what they call basketball.
There go the rest of the listeners.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
Hey, Hari.
Hey, Kamau.
How's it going, sir?
It's going all right. It's early on a Wednesday morning on April 12th. So people are wondering, we're recording this the week previous, okay? So if there are things that you don't like about the show that you're hearing on April 12th, you can go to hell. And and to be honest, if we had recorded this closer to April 19th, I would still tell you to go to hell.
This there's a second season you is different than first season you. First season you was filled with love. It really
is that
it
true?
Was the season
I don't
finale.
Know if that's true. Is that true?
I think the season finale cliffhanger episode we did about the end of the country really sort of has changed you for season two, Hari. So
I don't
you're filled with more vim and vinegar.
I don't like our fans as much as I used to.
Okay. All right.
I don't dislike them. I'm just saying that I'm before I felt like we were, it was just a giant hug. And what I didn't know is when they were hugging us, they had a blade right near their chest so they could poke it into my heart.
Most of our fans don't have blades near their chest.
It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. Obviously not.
This is a weird time to promote our live shows. Right. Hey, politically reactive listeners. Me and Hurry are doing some live politically reactive shows. And we want you guys to turn out because we're not doing a ton of these. We're only doing two right now. So you may need to make this into a road trip thing if you want to see Hurry up close and hug him in a way that makes him feel better about his fans. So we will be at the Limestone Comedy Festival in Bloomington, Indiana. The show is Friday, June 2nd. You can get tickets at limestonefest.com. And we'll be at the Comedy Central Colossal Clusterfest in San Francisco. That's on Sunday, June 4th. You can get tickets at clusterfest.com. We don't have a lot of live shows scheduled because our schedules are so busy. So this is a rare opportunity to see us do this show live. We will have guests. Because these are both comedy festivals, we'll probably have super awesome comedy guests.
And I'll be in Minneapolis at the Cedar on April 26th. I don't know why you're not buying tickets, Minneapolis. It bothers me greatly. Just because I told some of you to go to hell, I find it really inconsiderate for you to just leave me in a room by myself talking into a microphone. So just please purchase tickets and show up at the show already. This is absurd that I have to remind you. Please, Minneapolis, come on. Get your shit together.
It's a strange way to encourage people to come to your shows.
People like authoritarianism, Kamal. Things have changed around here.
So I'd like to talk to the people who listen to Politically Reactive who are fans of mine. Hey, guys. Love you. My book's coming out. The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamal Bell. Going on a book tour. Come see me talk about my book with cool people. Especially come see me Friday, May 5th at the Largo Theater in Los Angeles. Roxanne Gay will be doing the event with me. Come on, everybody. I love you. Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamal Bell. Book comes out May 2nd.
All right, let me
tell you. That was way better.
Let me tell my fans to go to your show, too. Hey, go to fucking Kamal's thing. He asked his fans to go. You should go to Kamal's thing. What's wrong with you? All right, I got him.
Okay. All right. That brings us to a very interesting segue, feedback we've gotten from listeners.
Oh, no. This is going to be bad.
I don't know. So it's going to be worse after this episode.
Why is Hurry so mean? Just because we insulted him repeatedly on the internet.
Okay, so thank you for tweeting to the hashtag politically reactive. We read those tweets. Both of us often favorite those tweets, which doesn't mean it's our favorite tweet. It just means we're sort of going, we see you. Sometimes it's like, we see you. Sometimes it's like, we see you.
That's creepy, man. What does that mean?
No, like the same thing you were just talking about. Like, hey, I see you talking bad about me.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. I just blindly favorite everything. So there's people who have threatened to kill me that I'm like, I love it. It's good.
So let's go through some of these. Hari, you can start.
Sure. This one's from Resist 45, Puppet Trump 75. That is very, if there was a stereotype of what our fans would be called on Twitter, it would be Resist 45 at Puppet Trump 75. That's exactly our demographic. This was sent to at Akila, obviously. Hashtag politically reactive made me realize that sometimes I give millennials the white people treatment. At Hari Kundapolu, my bad. That's interesting. I mean, I don't think it's quite the same thing.
I mean, but I do think that she pointed out something very interesting that, you know, that she's able to separate her bad treatment from bad treatment as a black person, bad treatment as a woman, and also bad treatment as a millennial. Like, I think that that's good for her for being able to see those fine lines.
Yeah, but what does she know? She's a kid.
Oh, boy.
There's another hate mail. There we go.
We got another tweet from one of our politically reactive all-stars, one of our favorite guests. All of our guests are our favorite guests. Rosa Clemente, at Rosa Clemente. She tweeted to me, at W. Kamal Bell, I got those digits to the Nation of Islam, Fruit of Islam for you. Who you think kept me and Cynthia safe in 08? With a smiley face winky emoji. so you know it's real. So yeah, so Rosa, I might reach out to you and get those digits, or maybe I won't. I don't think I want people to know if I did or not. So yeah, but it is interesting to know. We did get some people talking about that episode, and specifically the Nation of Islam part. I do think we should get someone from the Nation on to talk about what it is to be in the Nation in the 21st century.
This next one's from Jonathan Eby, at Jonathan Eby. This was sent to me and Kamau on Twitter. Can hashtag politically reactive do an episode on environmental racism? So excited for season two. We should. We definitely should. And if you have suggestions on who we should talk to, of course, keep sending them in. It's been great getting suggestions for people to talk to about healthcare in the Supreme Court. So if you have some thoughts, please tweet it at us. One thing you shouldn't do is email me at my personal account. Stop doing that.
Once again, the theme for season two, listeners, leave Hari alone.
Yep.
So anyway, everybody, keep those tweets coming. Keep the emails coming. We've got a lot of emails. People want us to talk about safe spaces, which we talked about a little bit in an angering way on our SE Cup episode. People want us to talk about healthcare. We are working on a healthcare episode actually with the doctor or professor that was suggested to us. People want us to talk about transgender issues. We will do that. Voting rights. Hopefully we're going to talk to Jason Kander.
A little bit of housekeeping. You all should know we're moving to Thursday. That gives us an extra day to do the podcast, which will improve its quality and also give us another night to sleep, which is very exciting.
And once again, our guest today is Michael Skolnick. We recorded this interview with Michael on March 13th. So while it is all relevant, it is not all necessarily topical to now. So listener alert, the world still sucks. So I think you'll understand all of this. All right, let's get Michael in here. Thanks for coming. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
No, it's great to have you, man. I've wanted to talk to you forever, so this is really exciting.
Well, I have to say, I was in L.A. A few weeks ago having breakfast with a friend, Piper Parabo.
Oh, Piper's great.
Who's like a big fan. Oh, so when I got the email, I was like, this is for Piper.
Oh, no, Piper's fantastic.
My question, Michael, is, so you're at a party, you meet somebody you never met before, and they ask you, so what do you do for a living? What do you say?
Or my mother calls.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
All these years, what are you doing? What do I do for a living? Well, first and foremost, I do my best to be a great father to my four-year-old son. So that's my first job, is to wake up every day and watch cartoons and wrestle, which I'm getting better at as the Power Rangers season, you know, continues. So my whole life I've tried to tell stories, and whether that was as a filmmaker for 12 years making films, whether that was running a business with Russell Simmons and as a president of a company that was a website geared towards young people, globalgrind.com. And now in my new iteration, I've created a creative agency doing large-scale social impact campaigns. But the bottom line to all the work that I've always done has been around compassion and equity and authenticity, really trying to push forward, right, a narrative of compassion in this country and certainly around the world. But I've changed careers over time in terms of, you know, how I get paid and how I am able to buy a sandwich, you know, every couple of days. But it's always been trying to uplift a level of compassion.
Well, first of all, I just want to say the person at the party is like, wait, what do you do?
Yeah, exactly. And I say, let's go get a drink.
Exactly.
But you know, the good news is I don't ruin a party anymore. So that's the good news. Before, it's like, oh, Skolnick's here. Shit, we got to talk about politics. So now at least folks want to talk to me at the party.
Well, you're amongst friends. I think. I mean, come on, you've been accused of being a killjoy like me, right?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah.
Many times.
So how did you come to all this? I mean, you know, you say you're a storyteller, but what is teenager Michael Skolnick look like that ends up here, you know?
Well, funny you ask. When I was 14 years old, I was had an odd childhood. I had incredible parents who sort of allowed me to live out my dreams. And we had a family friend who had an empty apartment in New York City. And I convinced them that I could live there in the summertime and take an internship for a Broadway producer. And at nighttime, I would be an usher at the Delacorte Theater, Shakespeare in the Park.
Wow.
And I was 14. I was making minimum wage. I was one of 35 ushers. I was the only white kid out of the entire, you know, ushering crew. And so it's my first time in my life that I was a minority, first in my life that I had to, you know, prove myself to a group of people. And opening night of The Tempest, 1995, Patrick Stewart playing Prospero, Claire Danes walks into the opening night party as the star of my so-called life. And I was like, I'm going to dance with her. Right? Like, no matter what, I'm going to dance with her. And I tried my best. And she said no. And all the ushers were like, you know, were making fun of me and making jokes. And this one, you know, young man, he was 17 at the time. I was 14, Omar Green, who was an usher. It was 3 a.m. The party was over. And he was, let me walk you out of the park. This is 1995, you know, New York City, just in case, you know, make sure you're okay. And Omar walked me out of the park, and we got to 5th Avenue and 79th Street at the edge of the park where the park meets the road. And it was that sort of an odd cliche moment of him trying to take it, you know, hail a taxi cab to go home. He lived in Harlem. I lived down the block, and nobody would stop for him. And I was 14. I was like, what's going on? I looked up to him. He was 17. He was, you know, an older kid. And no taxi. They kept passing him by and passing him by and passing him by. And I sort of saw this change in attitude of happiness coming out of a party to sort of disgust and disdain. I didn't know what that was at the time. I didn't know that was white privilege. I didn't know that was race, but I knew it was wrong. And I walked home that night and I was like, shit, I have something he doesn't have. And that was the moment that I began my racial journey towards consciousness. I had no idea what it was. I was still trying to get a dance with Claire Danes, but I knew something was wrong. Yeah. And my life, you know, 23 years later has been trying to sort of right that wrong.
I mean, it's fine, man. Sometimes it's that straightforward. Just like you meet people that are different than you are, and you see what you have and what they have, and you know something's wrong. But the first step of actually putting yourself in a position where you're a minority when you have white privilege, I mean, that can be the hardest part.
And it was, you know, it was an amazing moment in American, you know, sort of pop culture. You know, rap music hadn't hit the suburbs yet. You know, the suburban kids like me were still listening to Whitney Houston and Boyz II Men.
Right.
And, you know, Biggie and Jay and Nas, you know, they were new to the suburbs, but they were not new to the urban community.
Right.
And so there was, but Run DMC and the Beastie Boys, which I sort of grew up on, was safe for white kids to listen to. But all of a sudden there was this emergence of this authentic storytellers of Nas from Queensbridge. And Jay from Brooklyn and Biggie from Brooklyn that was coming out. And as a white kid growing up in New York, it was voyeuristic at first, right? Mm. It was like, whoa, what is this? And then I was working with these kids who were coming from these communities, who grew up in the same housing projects as Jay-Z, who came from Queensbridge, who grew up in, you know, Harlem and was talking about Uptown, where I was foreign to that story and I was foreign to that reality. And so during this time, not only was I being challenged amongst my personal relationships, but I was also being challenged amongst society as it was growing into an urban culture that was taking over the world.
Right.
And I wanted to be part of that. Right. I wanted to listen to the words of Nas and Illmatic and never understand it, but be appreciative that the kids I was working with as my friends were going through the same realities.
Michael, I'm not sure if you know this, but Lex Luthor got elected president last November.
Yeah. My son told me that.
Yeah. But how is this resistance going? In your opinion, how is the resistance going?
He's playing a lot of golf. so that's probably some good news.
Right, right.
I chair the board of the organization that organized the Women's March, and that was founded by Harry Belafonte 10 years ago called the Gathering for Justice. So I had a front row seat to these remarkable women, including my partner, Paola, who was the artistic director of the march, to the women who led this march and who organized and created the march. I got to be in Washington and help out wherever I could as the chair of the board, but certainly took a back seat to the leadership of these phenomenal women and the co-chairs of Linda, Carmen, and Tamika, and Bob, and the 20-plus women who organized this.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
Hey, everyone. Producer Erica here. I just wanted to clarify some of the names that Michael just mentioned. Tamika Mallory, Linda Sarsour, Bob Bland, and Carmen Perez. Tamika, Linda, Bob, and Carmen are organizers and national co-chairs of the Women's March on Washington. They also organized A Day Without a Woman, the day-long strike for women's rights where they were arrested after blocking traffic outside Trump International Hotel in New York. They're all veteran activists involved with some amazing projects, so we hope you check out and support their work. And Tamika, Linda, Bob, and Carmen, you're always welcome on our show. Speaking of which, back to Michael.
I remember coming home the next day on Sunday morning from Washington and being on the train and walking down the Amtrak car and seeing 98% of the train was women and pussy hats everywhere. Right? I mean, just a sea of pussy hats on this train. And I was thinking to myself, A, I've never been on the Amtrak train where there's such a disproportionate amount of one gender. But I sat in my seat and I listened to stories being told of women next to me and behind me and in front of me. And there are stories of resilience and there are stories of joy. And one woman was saying, oh, I miss Madonna because I was marching over here. And people were crying and laughing and talking about where they were during this speech or that speech and who moved them the most. I never thought, you know, I was at Javits Center the night at Hillary's, you know, victory, quote unquote, party, the night of the election and the devastation that so many people in this country felt when Trump was elected. I never thought in a million years that we'd be in Washington on the same weekend of his inauguration and people would feel a sense of joy. And not only a sense of joy, but a sense of resilience. So I think that the resilience of women when this man was so nasty and so degrading and so disgusting and despicable towards women, not just during this campaign, but throughout his career and his life, that they had the ability to bounce back so quickly and show this country that if they could do it, then we had to do it.
Right.
The fact that there is this resilience led by women and immigrants and Muslims and LGBTQ communities, as a white man, as a straight white man, I feel a daily duty to show up. Because they are the ones who are being attacked. They are the ones who are being threatened. They are the ones whose boot is on their neck, and we have to show up and support. So I think the resilience is strong. I think it's getting stronger. I think you look at these town halls and the Indivisible Guides and these groups that have town hall projects, that the Bo Willimons or that have sprung up. The Republicans are scared shit to go home and go to a town hall. Right? They don't want to go home and speak to the people because they know they can't deliver on these promises that Trump has offered to his voters. And they have some reconciling to do with their own constituents that is it's painful to watch.
Are you in any way worried about the fact that resistance can be exhausting and that eventually people just sort of go, you know, Iron Fist just started on Netflix. I'm going to have to resist. You know, and I ask this because you've been posting lists of things to do, ways to resist. What are those lists about and how do you respond?
Yeah, it can be exhausting. You know, resistance and the work is there is certainly a fear that people get tired and get worn out and this thing and they wait us out. I think the good news is I have great hope that this movement will be sustained, but we have the work to do. And Trump, he can't, they can't be let off the hook at any moment because how dangerous they are. This is, and I speak to some friends on the Republican side, and I said, when Obama was president, I knew you hated him, I knew you didn't like him, but you didn't wake up on Saturday worried about what Obama was going to do that day. He sort of let you know what was going to happen and what his plans were. This guy, you know, you see Kellyanne Conway on TV today talking about Obama was, you know, spying on him through a microwave.
But we don't know that that's not true, Michael Skolnick.
Well, we don't know. I'm checking my microwave tonight to make sure Obama's not inside of mine.
It just feels like the way they lie is really unique because it wasn't like George W. Bush lies of like half truths and kind of manipulating. It's like there's proof they did something and then they say they didn't do it. Like basically they're taking like It Wasn't Me by Shaggy and just following that advice to the T.
So let's look at the strategy for a minute. So for full disclosure, I've had the chance to meet and be with Donald Trump many times over the course of my life because of his relationship to Russell Simmons, who was my partner for 8 years. And Donald wrote the foreword to Russell's first two books.
Wow.
And Rev Run of DMC was very close to Donald over the years and traveled to Mar-a-Lago almost weekly with Donald. I've been to his office. I've been had dinner with him. I've spent time with him. And there is a behavior that that I've known and that I'm watching that is pretty consistent. And so what's happening, I think, was important for those who are listening, for us who are in the resistance, to sort of analyze and to look at, is Donald's strategy is to destabilize institutions and to delegitimize institutions, so and to create so much mud that people don't know which way is up and which way is down. So what he's done on the idea of news, right, and this attack on the media business, and this attack on the idea of fake news. Now, if you talk about fake news, you're bringing in the traditional media, CNNs, Fox News, New York Post, New York Times, Washington Post, when the fake news issue is really about truly fake news, totally made up fake news that was coming out of Eastern Europe, that was these, you know, these bots that were coming up and creating fake news. But he's been able to tell a story and people believe the story that fake news is all news and all news should be analyzed. And what has happened is because they lie so much and they know exactly what they're doing when they lie, is that we as the American people have, that's media, that's politics, that's politicians, and we sort of given up on the idea that these people are pathological. Mm. And the pathological is not always because they believe that they are lying. The pathological is that they want to destabilize institutions so then they can come in and do some really dangerous things. As an example, the Muslim ban. The Muslim ban, they know, is unconstitutional. They know it's unconstitutional. They don't care. It was never about the Muslim ban. It was about the courts. So they come in, they create a Muslim ban. Mm. They know it's unconstitutional. They know that the courts are going to strike it down. Then they come in and say, you know what? It wasn't us. It's the courts that are not protecting the American people. The courts are the ones that are going to, you know, allow terrorists to come into this country. We have to change the court system. And what Obama couldn't do was he couldn't get federal judges through the Senate. So there's 200 plus federal judgeships open that McConnell has been waiting to stack. So now they say, oh, American people, the courts are the problem. We have to get rid of these liberal judges. Let's stack the courts. And once you stack the courts, game's over, right? Now we're finished. Now they run court cases through the court system to the Supreme Court and we lose. So this was never about the lie. So we get caught up in fighting the lie. Right. Oh my God, look at Trump. He's such a liar. No. Look around the lie.
So it's also partly lazy journalism where we're focused on the immediate lie and not on the actual bigger
because
issue.
The lie pisses you off.
Right.
The lie is like, you piece of shit. How could you say that Obama did? You know Obama didn't do that. How dare you claim that a president, you know, the predecessor, you know, committed a felony against you when you know damn right you could pick up a phone and tell the American people whether this is true or not. So we get stuck in that. And then they see the news cycle in there and they can say, okay, they're going to forget about the real problem, which is the Russians, right? Which is Michael Flynn, you know, being paid by the Turkish government and being a foreign agent while he was advising the president-elect.
So I feel like I have to ask this question. You said that you have been out to dinner with Trump and you've been around Trump because of your dealings with Russell. Is there any part of you that feels like, maybe I should have done something different at dinner?
Yeah. I mean, look, Russell and I went to go see Donald in 2012 when he was attacking Obama on the birth certificate. And we sat in his office in Trump Tower, and he had on a side table in his office, he had yard signs, Trump 2012, Trump for president 2012. And he had a big binder of Iowa. And I said, Donald, are you running for president? He said, yeah. And I said, in 2012, in this election cycle, he said, I don't know. I said, I think Obama's going to whoop your ass. Like, I don't think you can take on Obama. And he said, yeah, I think you're right. I think I have to wait 2016. And we had a very contentious argument during the hour and a half we were in the office about Obama and about the birth certificate. And Donald really believed that Barack was a Muslim from Kenya, like really believed it, and basically told us to, you know, get out of his office and go get a life because this was true. And so, you know, do I wish in hindsight that we had gone back to him over and over again to keep, you know, pushing him to sort of stop the bigotry and stop the nastiness? Sure. I mean, I sat next to Donald at a dinner one time at the Waldorf Astoria for a charity event. And this is, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. And it was for a very rare children's disease. And the guy whose table it was, who's a dear friend of Donald and friend of Russell's, got on stage and pledged $1 million to this charity and said to the audience in the Waldorf, like, who's gonna match me? And Donald literally was sitting, you know, I'll go under oath. My grandfather's grave, may my grandfather rest in peace. He was sitting right next to me and he raised his hand and he was like, $1 million, I'm in. And the whole place exploded. like exploded in craziness because he was $2 million raised in 15 seconds for this amazing charity of this beautiful family. And David Fahrenthold from the Washington Post saw a picture of me at the event and called me during the election and said, do you remember what happened? I said, yeah, Donald pledged $1 million. Check it out. And he went and looked at it, and Donald gave nothing.
Oh, of course.
And like literally $0. And so do I wish, you know, I took Donald very seriously from the minute he entered the race because we knew him. And we also knew that, you know, he was tapping into something of white anxiety that he knew very well how to do. And he had done it his whole life, and he was very good at it. And he was, and going back to the lies, interestingly enough, Steve Bannon was at a film company that tried to buy a movie of mine 12, 13 years ago, and he was the head of acquisitions. And when I heard the name, I remembered, and I went back in my emails, and I found these emails between me and this guy, Steve Bannon, who was trying to buy a movie. Donald's a media guy. He's not a real estate guy. Ask anyone in New York City who does real estate, Donald Trump, like, he's not a real estate guy. He doesn't own anything. He owns one building or two buildings. He puts his name on things. He brands himself. He sells his name as a license to hotels and clothing and buildings. And Bannon was a movie guy. He was a wannabe screenwriter, a wannabe producer. These guys have told a story. And we are trying to talk in reality, and they're talking about perception. So I think our big mistake in our resistance is not to try to fight reality because they're not in reality. They're just selling a brand. We have to sell a brand. And part of the brand that we have to sell is that the people are on our side. The majority of America believes in what we believe in. Not only that the majority of America didn't vote for Donald Trump, the majority of America who couldn't vote, whether they're under 18, whether they're disenfranchised, whether they're formerly incarcerated, right, where they couldn't get to the polls, whether they were locked out of the system because of gerrymandering or because of voter ID laws, right, then we're overwhelming majority of people who are on our side. So we have to begin to tell the story that this guy does not represent the people of this country. He represents a small amount of people who voted on election day, who believe in what he believes in, but the minute he can't deliver, they're gonna leave him.
We'll be right back after we take care of some business. And some business.
All right, back to the show. Michael, you've worked a lot with celebrities on progressive campaigns, and, you know, It's an interesting thing because it's almost like they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, because if celebrities say something, oh, another celebrity with an opinion. If they don't say something, why aren't you using your privilege to do something? So, I mean, how do you navigate around that, and what kinds of things have you worked on with
Before you answer that question, Michael, I just want to say, hurry, you're a celebrity. Stop trying to act like you're not in that mix, Mr. Famous Guy.
I am not a celebrity.
Stop trying to talk like celebrities are something different. Those celebrities.
You got that blue check mark. Oh. You got that blue check mark. Yes. So there's a belief around celebrities and influencers of, you know, what's their purpose and do they help or do they harm or how much are they invested? And if I think back, Paul Robeson, who maybe one of the greatest, you know, actors and artists of American history, said that artists are the gatekeepers of truth. We are civilization's radical voice. Artists have an innate ability to tap into something that is beyond truthful because they can then portray it. If you look at Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man, I mean, just, you know, phenomenal. If you look at, you know, the performances in Moonlight, just phenomenal performances to transcend something that is truthful they find inside of themselves. Harry Belafonte then goes on. Robeson was Belafonte's mentor. So Belafonte, as mentor of mine, but a mentee of Paul Robeson, says, when the movement is strong, the music is strong. So when the movement is strong, the music is strong. If you look at the March on Washington, August 28, 1963, Belafonte charters an airplane, Pan Am flight, to Washington with the greatest artists of that moment, Bob Dylan, Charlton Heston, oddly enough, Marlon Brando, Peter, Paul, and Mary, right? All the Mahalia Jackson, all these folks come down on a plane with Belafonte to support King and to support John Lewis and to support Bayard Rustin in this March on Washington. So even then, 50-some-odd years ago, they played a critical role. Belafonte tells a great story when John Lewis was a kid, you know, and running SNCC as a teenager and was in Mississippi with Bob Moses, and they'd run out of money. They called Belafonte and said, can you bring us some money? And him and Sidney Poitier, who also wants to march on Washington, him and Poitier go to Mississippi on an airplane with $65,000 in cash in a suitcase because they didn't trust the Western Union. So they delivered it in by hand. So what's happened today is the movement is strong. So our job as artists, our job as celebrities, our job as influence is to support the movement because then we are a reflection of the movement. So we have to show up for the movement, shine spotlights, amplify, lift up, create. You know, Beyonce creates Lemonade because of the movement, not because Beyonce one day woke up and said, I want to create Lemonade. If I was advising any celebrity or any influencer, listen to the movement. Right. Listen to the movement. Where is the movement needed? What is needed by the movement? So last night, I just came in from L.A. this morning. I flew to L.A. yesterday morning. I left last night. I was there for 12 hours. And myself and Matt McGorry, who's an actor on How to Get Away with Murder, we organized around 30 white actors, actresses, directors, showrunners, creators in a room to talk about how white people can work on race. And it was a white affinity group, and it was all white people in a room, and most of them have never done any work on race. And many of them were like, why is there only white people here? And said, so we have work to do ourselves as white people. And for many of them, it was transcendent to their own, you know, personal journeys because they've never been involved in things like that. So we have work to do ourselves as an entertainment and a creative community, but we also have work to do with the movements that are emerging. And so I don't judge. If somebody wants to tweet and that's their first moment of action, tweet. Someone wants to show up to a rally, show up to a rally, but just listen to the movement.
I mean, we had our mutual friend Dream Hampton on, and Dream was talking about advising John Legend because John Legend wanted to know what he could do. And she said, like, you know, you show up, but don't speak for a year. Don't speak. Just take it in. I think that's very much what you're saying, right? Like, listen to the movement. If the movement needs you to speak, speak. If the movement wants you to shut up and fund things. But keep, you know, it's not about you.
Exactly right. And look at the Women's March. Zendaya came to the Women's March and just showed up. That kind of leadership matters. It reverberates amongst their peers. And I'm deeply appreciative because we've waited for this time. We've waited for people who weren't involved or who were told by their publicists or told by their agents, don't do it. It isn't the right thing for your career, to say, you know what? I feel like I got to say something.
Well, switching gears a little bit, but also talking about allyship. How often in your life do you have to tell somebody that you're not black?
let me say for the record, I am white man, straight white man. You know,
wait, do you mean heterosexual white man or I'm straight white man? Like I'm all white man.
Both. You know, it's I usually lead with that. No, so there's no there's no confusion. And people say, well, you got to be something. And I say, what does that mean exactly?
I like you too much for you just to be a white man.
Yeah, exactly.
You couldn't possibly care this much. What do you have at stake here?
Well, I get that question asked a lot. And that's a fair question.
Right.
I say it loudly because I want other white people to know that you can do this work too. And I do this work not to just to be an ally. I do this work because I believe that racism is a cancer. I believe that I've been brainwashed over the course of my lifetime by so many parts of society to believe that I was superior, to believe that I was better than, to believe that, you know, I worked hard, therefore that's what I got because I worked hard. And I don't want to hold that cancer. I think, you know, cancer sucks. Fuck cancer, right? As that great campaign says, I don't want to hold that cancer inside of me. So I want to rid myself of that cancer. So I do this work partly because I want to be free, right? I don't want to carry baggage to this world. I don't want to look at a black young man and be afraid. I don't want to drive my car through a neighborhood and lock my doors. That kind of anxiety, that kind of fear, right? That holds me back, you know, if I carry that. But I also do it because I want other white people to see an example. Not that I'm a model example, but I make many mistakes and I try to learn from them. But to see an example of a white person who believes that my liberation, that my freedom, that is bound up in the freedom of people of color, that is bound up in the freedom of the LGBTQ community, because I can't look at my friend, my partner, my colleagues, and and go home at night and say, oh, my life is great, but they got stopped by the police because of the color of their skin, or they didn't get a job because of the gender of their body. That's not freedom for me. That is a half freedom, a fake freedom, a pathological lie that America has told ourselves as white people that everything is going to be okay because we are okay. So I get that question asked every day, even by members of my own family. Like, are you sure? Are you sure you're one of us? Are you sure? My parents. You know, my parents were. My father was in Chicago in '68. My mother, you know, was an ally growing up in the South and rode in the back of the bus as an ally. You know, with black people during the Civil Rights Movement. So I was taught by my parents of almost all the things that I hold. And I give them a tremendous amount of credit for teaching me compassion at a very young age. But certainly, and then you grew up in hip hop. You know, you know, I had a rap group at 12 years old.
You did?
You know, Money and Cash. before Cash Money, before Birdman and Wayne took my name. But
Money and Cash.
Money and Cash going on stronger, kicking your beep.
Oh, wow. Put some respect on that name.
That's right.
Another thing I want to ask you about, and this is changing gears a little bit again, is just that, you know, you've also done a lot of the work in the, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, whether it's that name or not, but certainly the movement to end police brutality in this country. So you had dinner with Mike Brown's mom, Leslie, and Mike Brown has been in the news again recently. I just wanted your thoughts on that.
Okay, to follow up on what Kamau said about Mike Brown being in the news. Last month, new surveillance video footage emerged from inside Ferguson Market and Liquor several hours prior to Brown's shooting. This is part of the debut of the documentary Stranger Fruit at the South by Southwest Film Festival. Director Jason Pollock says the footage raises questions about police claims that Brown was committing robbery when he took cigarillos from the store later that day. Instead, Pollock says the footage shows Brown trading marijuana for cigarillos and leaving the cigarillo boxes for safekeeping and pickup later that day. St. Louis County's top prosecuting attorney called the release of the footage, quote, pathetic, and an, quote, attempt to distort and turn this into something it wasn't. Whatever the prosecutor may say, it doesn't take away from what is still true. There's no reason Mike Brown shouldn't be living today.
She called me. I have played, humbly, I played counsel to many families. I proudly sit in the board of directors of the Trayvon Martin Foundation, which Trayvon's family began, and have been very close to Trayvon's parents since the death, you know, since the week after the death of their son. I sat in the courtroom with them during their entire trial. I sat in the courtroom with Jordan Davis's parents, Lucy and Ron, during their trial of the murder of their son. I've done my best to play counsel to families who have asked. And Leslie called me around midnight one night a few years back, and she was in town. This is before the decision on the indictment or non-indictment of the officer who killed her son. And she called me around midnight and asked if I would come have dinner with her. She was speaking at CNN, and she was on CNN. They had flown her in, so she was staying in that area. And I hopped in the car and drove over to CNN Center, and we sat in this a restaurant in Time Warner Center that's open late, and we sat till I think 3-4 in the morning, and it dawned on me how young she is as a mother. You know, she's younger than me. I'll be 39 this year, and she had an 18-year-old son, and no one prepares you for these moments. I'm a father of a 4-year-old. I had, you know, my partner and I had a very terrifying experience when he was one, when he went to a seizure, he had a febrile seizure, and I had to give my son mouth-to-mouth resuscitation at 1 year old. I thought I was losing my son. And this is in no comparison of anyone's pain and what they've gone through. But for a moment, I thought my son was dying in my arms. And it was horrifying, you know, my worst experience of my life. And I can't even imagine actually losing my child. And when you lose your child, this kind of exposure, when the world is now watching you and you're on the cover of papers and you're on TV every day and you're being attacked left, right, and center and supported left, right, and center, just sitting with her and listening to the struggles of dealing with all this and not knowing who to trust and not knowing who to talk to and not knowing where to turn to and not knowing what's true, what's not true. I've just tried my best and I've been criticized and oftentimes rightfully so. I've tried my best to be of counsel and to be of support, not for any such personal gain. When I go on TV or I talk on radio, I've lived a full life at this point, and I just do my absolute best to uplift those stories, to use those opportunities to make sure. I mean, when I was at Global Grind, you know, we created 800 plus stories around people who had been killed and just trying to give them a name, called He Has a Name and She Has a Name campaign. Trayvon was 800 and something, right, of He Has a Name, Trayvon Martin. Ayanna Jones, who was killed in Detroit, Michigan at 7 years old, I flew to her funeral. I just sat in the back of the funeral hall just to be present, and not to, you know, take up space, but just to show them that they have support from around the country and that Russell was supporting them, that we were supporting them. And then this movement emerged, after Trayvon, of Black Lives Matter, by three phenomenal women who started this campaign.
Once again, let's make sure we acknowledge the three black women who started Black Lives Matter: Patrice Cullors, Alicia Garza, and Opal Tometi. Go back to our first episode this season to hear our interview with Patrice Cullors. She is amazing, and her laugh is delightful.
And I've tried my best to be of service to them and to support them every step of the way that I could. And Dream Defenders out of Florida, who are and were phenomenal. Justice League out of New York, who are and were phenomenal. And so many groups that have taken leadership. And as a white person who has been doing this work my entire life, or 20 plus years, I've learned that this is not my moment. And this is my moment to step back or step to the side and listen to what the movement needs and try my best to offer what I can give. So my greatest achievements is to be of service to the movement, and that the movement succeeds, and that cops stop killing black people, and that young black people in this country have a chance, a real chance, not like let's get an education and that's the way out, but a real chance of having, you know, the life that my son can lead. So I go to work every single day for them. And when they call on me at midnight or noon, I will be there.
Michael, this has been great. Thank you so much for being here. But before you go, I have to ask you this, because you mentioned
yes.
this. You talked about a John Starks streetwear line that yes. you worked on. For those of you who don't know, John Starks was a shooting guard of the New York Knicks.
Maybe
in the 90s.
Greatest player of all time.
I mean, it's because outside of New York.
It's arguable.
Outside of New York, that won't make any sense. But if you were a New York Knicks fan and you were in New York in the 90s,
I just have
like
to interrupt
those Knicks
quickly.
Team, Starks, Oakley, Ewing.
Yeah, I was like Mason. I got to stop. I was in Chicago at the time.
He's a Bulls fan.
I know. There's a guy there. He's like Michael something.
Yeah,
right?
Okay. Continue, Knicks fans. Continue.
He was pretty good.
Yeah. Remember when Starks dunked over him?
Yeah.
And horse.
Left-handed. Oh, really. Left-handed. Yeah. From the baseline. Had the poster still in my room.
And how many championships did that win him in that day when he dunked over him? How many championships?
He got us negative one because in game 7 against the Houston
exactly.
Rockets.
Two for 16, was it? Yeah. I mean, it's weird because like Starks is like, you know, we didn't win them. The Knicks haven't won since the early to mid 70s.
Phil Jackson.
Like,
since Phil Jackson won a trophy for the Knicks.
Right.
He was suited up.
I think he's an undercover agent for the Bulls now, to be perfectly honest.
Foreign agent.
But I think that, like, you know, Starks very much embodies New York. You know, he's an overachiever. He busts his butt. Those Knicks teams do. So when you mention John Starks, I'm like, oh my God, you know the god John Starks?
I did 20 years ago. That's what I wouldn't say. I pivot back to social justice for a moment. There is like a monolithic viewpoint of who we are in this movement. And oftentimes, I think many of us get criticized, like you only can talk about social justice and you only can talk about, you know, the work. And, you know, when we start talking about music or sports or other things, we're like, well, you don't know anything about that. And I really don't, but I'm a fan of the Knicks and of sports. I played sports my whole life. And I do think there needs to be a breath as well in the work that we do. And folks also need to be allowed,
yes.
right, to go to the movies and to talk about sports.
To be human.
To be, you know, and so when we see folks on social media, some of the leaders in the movement who may deviate every once in a while to talk about something else, like that's also okay. And we shouldn't criticize them because they should be laser focused on
Well, that's
one
how
thing.
You connect with people who might not be down with what you're talking about or don't know. And all of a sudden you have this common interest and that's how you get people to pay attention because you become friends with them. You find
that's
that
right.
shared ground.
That's right. People think like for me, like, damn, you're so serious. And like, that's just Twitter.
Yeah,
I was a theater major. I went to circus school when I was 14. I dressed up in tights and I could juggle.
Right.
So we also have to enjoy ourselves and enjoy each other's company, but also continue to resist and not give up to this guy's out of office.
That's cool. Tell me about that streetwear line.
You know, it didn't last long. Right? Maybe 6 months. It had like Kangol before Samuel L. wore the Kangol.
John Starks Kangol?
Oh, it's fantastic.
Are they on eBay? Buy that?
And it had like, it wasn't like a full, you know, piece of material. So it had like, it breathed. So you could wear a hat in the summertime and like your head could breathe through the Kangol. But you could play ball in the Kangol. So yeah, it didn't last long, but he tried. He tried. He had a little money in his pocket. I think that was when he got excited, but I didn't last long.
Oh, man, that's great, Mike. Thank you so much for joining us,
I appreciate
us,
you guys. I'm big fans of both of you, so thank you for having me.
Hey, Hari, what did we learn today?
I learned that Claire Danes turned Michael down for a dance, which I found very amusing.
Ouch. I learned that, like me, Michael's first job is being a dad.
That's very sweet. My, like, fourth or fifth job is being a dad.
Which is great, since you're not a dad.
Yeah.
It shouldn't really be on your list of jobs at all. Stop trying to be a dad to people's kids.
Hey, come on, let me raise your kid for you. Come on, I'm here one out of every 7 days.
I learned that when Michael advises celebrities, he actually does the same thing that Dream Hampton does. He tells them to listen to the movement first before getting involved too heavily.
I learned that it's time for white folks to take a stand to the side and listen to the movement and what the movement needs. I didn't actually learn that, but it's good to reinforce that. Like, constantly. Like, every 10 or 15 minutes or so.
I learned that Michael told Donald Trump to his face that Obama was going to whoop his ass if he ran against him in 2012.
I also learned that he thought Trump believed his own birtherism, which is absurd.
Yikes.
The idea that that's he actually crazy. Thought that it wasn't just a ploy.
That really makes me feel even worse about everything. I learned that at age 12, Michael had a rap group called Money and Cash. I can't even say it seriously.
So bad. It's very bad. I learned that we need to sell our own brand in response to Trump and Bannon to tell the story that Trump does not represent most of us. Which I feel like, you know, we're getting there. We're doing a pretty good job with protests and things like that. But yes, we have to make it clear we are not down for this.
I learned that the bottom line for Michael is compassion and equity in all his work, no matter what medium he's working in or who he's talking to.
Thanks again to Michael Skolnick for joining us today. Follow him on Twitter at Michael Skolnick. Go follow him on Facebook, too, and really wherever you can. And check out his organization, Soze. Thanks to those of you who commented on Twitter using the hashtag PoliticallyReactive. Keep them coming, and please hit that subscribe button if you haven't done so already. And tell others to do the same. And hey, everybody, Kamau is about to go on tour to support his new book, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, which is out May 2nd. So make sure you buy his book and go see him. On May 2nd, he's going to be in Brooklyn, New York at the Bell House. On May 3rd, he's going to be in Washington, D.C. at Avalon Theater. May 4th, Chicago, Illinois at Art Center of Oak Park. May 5th, Los Angeles, California at Largo. And May 6th, Oakland, California at Starline Social Club. You can find more info and more dates at wkamaubell.com. Also, be on the lookout for the second season of his CNN show, United Shades of America. That's out on April 30th. As for me, I just released a surprise album called Hari Kondabolu's New Material Night, Volume 1. It's available on Bandcamp and iTunes. Also, my last proper album is still available, Mainstream American Comic, all over the place, like the internet. I'm also on tour. You can see me April 26th in Minneapolis at the Cedar Cultural Center. April 27th to the 29th, I'm in Madison, Wisconsin at the Comedy on State, doing 5 shows. May 4th through 7th, I'm in New York City at Caroline's on Broadway. If you use the code Cocoa Butter, you get a little discount on the Thursday and Sunday shows. And you can find all these dates at harikundabolu.com. Politically Reactive is a production of Topic and is distributed by Earwolf. The team includes Lital Malad, Lisa Langang, Erica Mu, and Max Jacobs. The show is engineered by Dan Gallucci. Welcome aboard, Dan. Thanks to Jared O'Connell at Earwolf Studios in New York, and thanks to Dennis Funk for additional recording help in Chicago. And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show.